the optimal life.
Yeah, so I thought you did an awesome job on the interview with Kristen Cavallari this past week. And that topic, narcissism, it's such a thing that I think more people are talking about now, more than ever, Dr. Sherry, but it still seems like people still really don't know what that really means.
Well, let's dive into it, you know, for a minute. The problem with the term right now is that it's overused. Not everyone is diagnosably a narcissist. There are criteria that require that diagnosis. And there are people, experts now saying there are 6 or 7 different types of narcissism. I learned it differently in my PhD. I learned that there are 6 or 7 cluster B personality disorders. What they all have in common is selfishness and a lack of empathy. So it's easier for the lay person to understand the combined of the 6 or 7 without using all the jargon as narcissistic and or toxic, poisonous, coercive, you know, so that you have one term for 6 different things. So it's amazing the kickback that we're getting, especially in the social media world, to the word narcissism, right? Because technically, if we're going to get technical, not everybody who's toxic is a narcissist, right?
True.
But
very true.
We can focus on the pattern of selfishness and a lack of empathy, whatever you want to call that. I call it toxic. That's overused, but let's just call it whatever we want to call it. If we want to call it narcissistic today, let's call it that, right? So as long as the listeners, if they really want to unpack it, they can go look at the cluster B personality disorders, and that will be very helpful.
Cluster B, correct. So you're talking, they all kind of overflow and overlap. They're all very much similar. They have a few slight modifications. You obviously know better than most, but whether you're talking borderline personality, bipolar, narcissistic, histrionic, probably one or two others. They're all twin siblings, kind of, right?
In some way. I would eliminate bipolar because that's an axis one disorder of the brain. The cluster B personality disorders are not a mental illness. They are a flawed character. So they would be borderline, histrionic, narcissistic, antisocial personality disorder, dependent personality disorder, and passive aggressive personality disorder.
Mm. And again, a lot of those, they overlap because a narcissist is going to be passive aggressive almost
Absolutely.
Every single time. Right.
Yes, correct. So what they all have in common and why we're trying to use one term like narcissistic or toxic is because they all lack empathy and they're all selfish. And so when someone is the center of their own universe, they essentially abuse us all in the same way. It doesn't really matter the exact title. Do you know what I'm saying?
Correct. So I'm curious, you've studied this for a long time. You've talked to and you've analyzed and evaluated a lot of people, from clients and maybe others in the court systems to your own personal lives.
Correct.
Where do you believe these personality disorders stem from? Are we born with them? Are they evolved because of some kind of upbringing from, you know, again, a tough upbringing with our parents, toxic parents? Where does this come from?
So there's a lot of debate over that. I believe that personality disorders raise other personality disorders. It's a character flaw. With character, we do have some level of choice, right? I feel like a lot of how someone's raised, they either got too little or too much, depends on how they mature, right? Optimal levels of frustration are necessary for growth. Too much frustration will fracture the identity and could possibly create some toxicity, right? Because on the other side of all of these character disorders are people who have people-pleasing tendencies, right? As a way to counterbalance the coercive control that's coming at them. And so I don't know that what came first, the chicken or the egg on that one. I fell down a rabbit hole. I was raised by two toxic parents and I had no contact with my family, which I made that decision in midlife. I figured I'd suffered enough in the first half. I didn't want to live the second half with the same type of abuse and lack of self. So my only choice, and I have a very, very extreme situation, but my only choice was to unplug from the poison. Then I could get to know myself and really live my life the way I want and to not live the second half of my life in that way. So not only have I studied them, but I've never not been around them. And I don't know that I would be in this position I'm in right now had I not been raised by them and have had to have the unfortunate no other choice but to save my own life by establishing no contact, right? So my mom and dad, there's 9 marriages between them. And they abused completely differently. My dad was very overtly narcissistic and physically abusive and emotionally violent. And my mom was just passively evil. And so
when you say passively evil, dig into that. What did that mean? What does that mean?
Passive aggressive, a lot of digs at me, you know, that were very meaningful, but that were hard to call out. I would want her attention. She would shove me away. As I became more like womanly, she sort of saw me as competition, was very mean to me about how I looked, my body, my weight, my intelligence. It would be, you're the shrink. I guess you know everything. You know, it was, she's just mean. She's very passive aggressive.
Do you remember when you started realizing like, hey, I feel like my relationship with my mother is different than maybe a lot of my friends' relationships with their mothers?
I would say the awareness of that wasn't until like my teenage years, but I grew up as a little child terrified. And I remember having to navigate and try to modulate the moods of my parents as they're making one marital decision after another and other men and women in between. It was my job as a child to make them feel okay about who they were as a parent.
So and you would try to make, I'm sorry, Dr. Sherry, yeah. you would make your mom, you would have to kind of make her feel okay because she would be emotional wreck. She wouldn't be able to control her emotions. She wouldn't be able to control what she was saying and feeling. You would try your best to make her feel good. And then instead of thank you, you would be called the shrink. Oh, thanks a lot. I need a shrink here.
100%.
Yeah. That's
like
exactly
my dad
it.
My dad hit me when I was 7 and he bloodied my nose because I accidentally kicked him while he was tickling me. So typically, you know, when the normal human being gets tickled, you kind of flail. Seems pretty normal to me. Then after he hit me, he went down the hallway and he was like crying. And he said to me, if you tell anyone, I'm going to go to jail and it will be your fault.
Wow.
So that's me. And I was like, it's okay, Daddy. I won't tell. I'm so sorry. I was such a bad girl when you were tickling me. And now I hate being tickled even to this day, right? And I'm 53. So I was parenting my parents from a really young age. I just did a TEDx talk and it's called Not All Parents Are Good. And culture just believes that if you have the title of mom or dad, that you're just inherently good. But that title isn't powerful enough to eliminate ingrained character deficits and abusive traits, because anyone can have a child, anyone. And children do not cause bad parents. But children are taking on the role of managing and navigating and trying to balance the moods of their parents.
That's absolutely heartbreaking. I have a 7-year-old daughter myself. When you're telling me the story right now,
yeah,
to think that you had to deal with that,
you had
to be abused physically and then manipulated mentally and emotionally, and then put on a show like a puppet in front of everybody.
Correct.
At that age.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And then you're living in all this, again, you're living the toxicity every single day.
Correct.
Just different forms.
Correct. 100%. And then navigating every new step parent and their kids and that dysfunction. And then my parents both were educated as school teachers, right? Like, could be so charming and so nice to everybody else's kids. But I had a golden child brother, and I got a home devil, you know, from each parent. They were different people socially than they were in my house toward me. And I really feel that the golden child syndrome is still another form of abuse. It's just a different kind. And, but I do think they're equally victimized. I just think they're victimized in a very different way. And I think golden children, and this isn't exhaustive of all golden children, but are more likely to be toxic later,
When
right?
you say
Because they've
golden
been
children, what do you exactly do you mean by golden?
the favored child.
The favorite, okay.
And then I was the scapegoat, right? So I was scapegoated for everybody's dysfunction. They made it mine. So it became our family would just be perfect if she wasn't a part of it. She's a mess. We don't know why. You know what I mean? So there are family roles because it's about conquer and divide in these families. They don't want siblings being close, to be quite honest, because they don't want any alignment that could overthrow the power of the most toxic person.
So, what back to what I was saying then, somebody like you would have been, if you had to take a look at you as a child and then into your teenage years. Somebody evaluating you, if they knew everything that was going on in your life, would have said Sherry Campbell is going to end up being a cluster B type personality in her adult life.
Oh, 100%.
So I'm curious on how you avoided that. You got to the fork in the road at some point and decided to go the other way. Did you talk us through that? What do you think it was?
Well, I think survival's genetic. I think some of us are really built for it, and I think some of us just aren't as resilient to it. I think that being the scapegoat, the end of the day, where I'm at in my life now is probably the greatest position I could have been. I was a scapegoat because I was a truth teller. You can't tell the truth in families like this. You're not allowed to confront your parents on their dysfunction, right? So they align with your siblings and they all go against you as a way to get you to succumb and just go along to get along. And I was unable to do that, which then caused me to believe I was the source of my own problems. I would be like, why can't I just shut up? Like, why can't I just like not say anything? Why do I have to say something? Well, because it was so wrong what was happening to me. And I would say something. I did get into therapy at 16. And I do think that that therapist was helpful. I'm old, I'm 53. So back in the day, they didn't use terms like narcissistic. But I was told that I wasn't the problem, that my badness was a symptom of all the trauma, but I was still considered bad. But that was actually very helpful for me to recognize that I wasn't, it wasn't my fault, at least, that I was so bad. People pleasing, I think, became my disorder. I just learned to tell my truth through writing in journals. I was an avid journal writer. And I stopped telling the truth externally as best as I could. It would leak out and then it would cause a fight. Then I would punish myself. My mom would tell me that I was the abuser. I would believe her because I did get mad because I couldn't recognize the passive aggressive abuse or the narcissistic stare. She truly made every effort in my life to make my life as hard as possible.
And do you think that she did that intentionally?
Oh, absolutely.
This is all conscious behavior.
All of
Because
it.
you know, because these type of people, they're so good at making you feel bad for them
Oh, yeah.
that sometimes you wonder, like, hey, are they consciously acting this way, or is this out of their
Yeah.
control, right?
Yeah, let's dive into that, okay? Because this is one of the greatest sources of frustration. that I have, and I mentioned this in my TED Talk, abuse is a conscious, intentional choice. We do not accidentally abuse someone. We all know right from wrong, because if we didn't learn it in the family system, we learned it in preschool, then we learned it in kindergarten, then we learned it K through 12. I mean, we learn it. So what toxic parents want isn't love or connection in a family. They want control and power. They're very divisive. So they might mix up control and power with love, but whatever form of love you're getting is going to be as twisted as their viewpoint on it. So instead of looking at right or wrong, they look at winning or losing. And so they just disregard, consciously disregard right or wrong to get what they want. If they're smart enough to manipulate in all of these masterful ways, then they are absolutely intelligent enough to know when they're hurting their victims.
Take me inside the minds of these people a little bit deeper, if you could. Because okay. I'm trying to understand their conscious thoughts, maybe subconscious thoughts and conscious thoughts. But what does it look like for these folks? Do they wake up and say, I can't wait to manipulate the world, I'm ready to gaslight? Like, what take us? Do you even know?
I did read one book that his words, I'll do my best to do his words justice, but it says, I'm a narcissist, and those who think that I am not have been fooled. I'm manipulating every single day, all day long. I'm the Machiavelli of manipulation. And what they want is attention and emotional reaction. And without those two things, they do not exist, which is why no contact works. He's a narcissist who writes about being one. And he goes into how does he secure the emotion and emotional reaction and attention is just through manipulation. So they don't care whether you're pouring your love all over them or whether you're berating them for their flagrant abusive behavior. As long as all your tears are caused by them, so long as you're begging them to see what they've done, so long as you're trying to confront them on the truth of how horrible the behavior is, that's all fuel to them. It's attention and emotional reaction, and that's what they need. Do they wake up and think, ooh, you know, like I can't wait to go out and manipulate? I don't think it's that black and white. I don't think they think in any other way. They know what they're doing is wrong, but what they're doing works for them. And they can't function unless there's a high level of attention and emotional reaction being thrown their way. So they play games to get that as a way to feel themselves as existing in the world.
The fuel for them, whether they're getting loved, showered with roses and positive love and harmony and attention, or on the complete flip side, being in a fight and negativity and yelling and screaming. Regardless, for these folks, I think what you're saying, and I believe is true, it's the same fuel.
Same fuel. And it's more potent, probably, depending upon who they're getting it from, right? So that's why they run this cycle of abuse of they idealize you, then they devalue you as soon as you're comfortable. Then they devalue you, then they get rid of you. And then they hoover, like suck you back in, because they love this game of you having all this relentless hope that will then turn to hatred for them because they drive you so insane. Then they're very satisfied once you're there. Mm. And I unpack this process of relentless hope to hate in my new book about emotionally abusive parents. And then they idealize you, they suck you back in, and you go all the way back to hope. And you just get so stuck, because when you're idealized again, it feels good. It feels so good to finally get love from this person, or love. We know what is feigned love, but it never lasts. It doesn't last more than a couple of weeks.
Right.
You know, and with yep. children, Seduction isn't even necessary. It's a given. We're already theirs. Right? So you don't have to seduce a child. You just have to shower them with a little love again. So I call it conditional kindness. They're bad people with good moments. They are not good people with bad moments.
That's powerful. You mentioned the book, Adult Survivors of Emotionally Abusive Parents. That's your newest book. Just came out recently. Yeah. Yes. We've linked that in the show notes. And let's keep digging into this. You grew up with this emotionally abusive parents. And I saw once, too, that somebody said a narcissistic parent sees no boundary between him or herself and their children. They see their children as mere extensions of themselves.
Have this idea that they have rights and children have obligations. How can a child be more obligated to a parent? We didn't choose to be here. We're decades younger with less skills. They made the choice to bring us here. I would think it's their responsibility to be obligated to us, that children have rights and parents have obligations. But they don't. You know, when most people that cut off from family do so in midlife, this isn't cancel culture where there's a spat. And then, you know, in today's world, ew, I cut you off. That's not what this is. Most survivors stay in for a minimum of 35 to 40 years, really trying to have the best relationships with their family that they could possibly have. But you get to a point when I think we get a big upgrade psychologically and spiritually in our 40s. And it's not birth to life anymore, birth to eternity. We have all this time to work on our relationships and all this time to have all these dreams. It starts becoming life to death in our perception. And we start to think, I don't know that I want to do my second half the same way I did my first. Right? And enough is enough of this abuse, because I know I cannot be my most authentic, independent self when independence is called anti-family. If you want boundaries and you want more independence from a toxic parent, they tell you you're a bad daughter, a bad son, you're anti-family for wanting what's developmentally normal and healthy. How does that make sense? So many of us either get cut off like I did, or we really greatly distance ourselves so that we can have the life and write the ending to our own story.
How old were you when you finally were cut ties with your parents?
42.
42. So just 11 42. Years ago.
42 with my father and brother, and then 45 with my mother.
And was it the same experience for both, or different reactions?
My father and brother, same reaction. And my mother was harder because I just really wanted a mom, as one would. But she was just so mean. And she cut me off because of a very small, insignificant incident where she followed the wrong car to a restaurant and she was mad that I had a nice car. So she cut me off.
This was 8 years ago.
Correct. Yeah, I'm 8 years totally no contact.
And what was your mother's relationship with your daughter?
Not much. My mom made it clear that she was never going to be the type of grandmother that watched grandchildren. She didn't want anyone.
For you, it was probably okay too, because you didn't want that personality type.
No, I mean, I never shared this with her, but when my daughter was first born and my mother would hold her, she came out when my daughter was like 5 days old. I wanted to just grab my daughter back from her. And I was at that time really looking at self-absorbed parents. And I was doing all this reading because I was having my daughter was a real awakening. I just really wanted to protect her in the ways that I wasn't. And my daughter didn't really like my mom because my mom was always very critical. So if my daughter showed more love to my mother's current partner, then my mom would be like, she likes him more, out loud. in front of my kid.
Wow.
She doesn't like me. I'm not the favorite. She likes him more. It's
Yeah,
like, oh my
you
God.
can't win around these
Can't
people.
win.
You can't win
No.
no matter what you say, what you do. Literally, it's a zero-sum game. It's a losing game.
And that's why we tap out. It's like my silence is so much more effective than my words were ever.
Yes. And again,
when you go,
that's driving your mother crazy, right, Sherry? Your mom, again, when you cut that, that attention, that spotlight's not on them, they're losing fuel.
Yeah, they are losing fuel. And it's interesting, some of the things that she's done. So, you know, my mom was allowed to silence me for weeks on end, regardless of my age, if I did anything she didn't want. So her way of silencing me is discarding me, right? But only to know she was going to suck me back in. So I don't really think she took me seriously because I always mended the fence. I was the slave in the relationship. So this time with the white car incident, I just was like, I'm not mending this fence anymore. I don't have it. I don't want no more tools. You know what I'm saying? And then she started hovering around at holidays where she would send very cryptic gifts for like 6 years. And then I put in a thing in the mail, like, just please stop. This isn't trying. You're sending me things that are broken with missing pieces and no gift receipt. And that's not who she ever was prior. It's just a game. My dad's death was used against me. My daughter's college education was taken from me. Like, it's just insane.
Yeah. Well, again,
I would
no matter what you did or didn't do, you can't win with these folks. You just
no,
have to
you can't.
Cut it
and I
off.
just got to the point where I'm like, my life is just so much better when I do it by myself. Right. And it's not easy. It's nothing anyone wants to do to amputate your family from your life. But like, if they're not working units and they're destroying you, that was my only choice.
This book, Adult Survivors of Emotionally Abusive Parents, How to Heal, Cultivate Emotional Resilience, and Build the Life and Love You Deserve. There's got to be many, many people, probably millions of people, that suffer from some form of this kind of upbringing. So let's dig into this a little bit with, when kids, maybe there's some young kids listening to this, teenagers or young adults, 18, college kids. And they're going through the same thing. What are some pieces of advice you have for these kids as they're growing up in the household and then eventually trying to start their own adult lives? How did they handle the parent?
Well, the more independent you get, the more abusive your parents will get. You know, you're a piece of property to them. It's a transactional relationship, but they want to own all the transactions. So they will cause problems for your marriage. They won't like whoever you marry, I promise. You will have your partner, whoever you're with, will have an interesting in-law situation. In many ways, it is kind of like leaving a cult. You know, so there's smear campaigns. So for these kids that are getting out of families that they want to stay connected to, but their family's very toxic, I would just navigate that mindfully and slowly. I would warn anyone that you're going to choose to date or marry about what they're dealing with or could possibly be dealing with, but you really need to listen to your body. Our mind will talk us out of nearly everything because even society is like, you're bad if you cut ties with your parents, like they're going to die one day and then you're going to feel guilty. I mean, all of these microaggressions that come our way for protecting our lives from our parents, this stuff is real. And it happens. And that's like a secondary form of abuse, right? Oh, your parents couldn't have been that bad. You turned out okay. I mean, we hear the vitriol around this is insane.
Right.
I got so stuck in my head trying to be this image of good in society that I ended up marrying the wrong person. And I just repeated my childhood in that dynamic. And then I brought my daughter through it. So I've really had to learn to quiet my mind and listen to my body and to understand that although toxic people don't get this, boundaries are designed to keep people in your life, not out. If I set a boundary, I'm like, hey, Nate, you know, that hurt my feelings when you did this. And you go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that was a sensitive area for you. I will certainly make efforts to no longer step in that area. Then I see that you love and respect me, and I want you in my life. In fact, I feel even closer to you because I felt seen. But when you set a boundary on someone really narcissistic, they're very allergic to this and they will rage. They'll play the victim. That's a form of rage, is playing the victim. How dare you even, how could you think I would be that way? It's like, oh my God. So you have a right to set boundaries. Every time you set boundaries, you get, you're giving people an opportunity to stay in. You cannot control if they don't take that opportunity. But if they're manipulating the boundary and turning you into an anti-family, bad son, bad daughter, how dare you listen to your body? Because they're going to do that forever. That's not going to change. And you're going to have to make decisions on proximity.
What about the, I mean, as these kids are coming up, is there a way to keep distance? I mean, the parent runs the show. So you're, I mean, looking back at your childhood, was there anything you could have done differently as a 13, 15, 17 year old?
I could have told the truth less. That would have protected me. But I couldn't keep it in because it was right. So, when you're more mature than your parents at 13, it drives you bananas, you know? When your parents seem ridiculous to you and you're only 13, that's a really hard thing to, like, one time I came home from a field trip and my dad forgot. And so I'm at the school, I'd been on a bus for 8 hours. So someone else took me home. And when I got home, his car was there. The door was locked. I couldn't get in. I kept knocking. He answered the door like this much. And he's like, what are you doing home? I'm like, I'm home. Like, how do you, 13, eighth grade, how do you not know when your child is coming home from a week-long field trip and you just don't show up? And I walked in and he's like, oh, well, go get changed quickly. I'm getting married. And he was marrying a lady I'd never met in my living room.
Wow.
I walked in on the middle of the ceremony.
You were always off balance.
Always. So you know what saved me, honestly, Nate, is I grew up in a really beautiful area of Colorado. And I was either in my room, writing in a journal, reading books, and escaping into other realities, or I was outside moving my body and getting away from these people.
What are some of the tips? I'm sure you, and I know you dig into this in the book, but at a high level, again, people that have struggled with this from their childhood into their adult lives, they're listening to this, they're resonating with this right now.
Yeah.
What are some of the high level things that people can do to start turning this around?
Knowledge is power. You know, I just did a video before you and I spoke, because I was on another show earlier this morning. And, you know, we get told a lot, oh, just love yourself. So to me, that's always been like, that's a little flippant. Like, I don't really get that. Like, how do children know if they're loved or not? Who are their teachers? By how their parents love them. I had no model for how to do that. So for me to loving myself is a result, not a pursuit anymore. I had to know myself to love myself.
Yeah.
So read, write in a journal, go to therapy, do your astrological chart, jump outside of psychology, get your life path number, know your Myers-Briggs personality inventory. A lot of businesses use that. Figure out who you are. Look at the combination of all the things that you find in a very whole way. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Get your Enneagram number. And you can kind of get to know yourself, and it will resonate because you're answering these test questions to create these results, right? And that is kind of where I started. I just started learning and reading. And then there were certain people out in the world that were visible that I really admired. And I would practice being the traits of theirs that I admired, like if they were elegant, or they were soft-spoken, or they were composed or discerning, things that I didn't have. Because I was such an overworker, overpleaser, overthinker. And a lot of that now isn't there. I definitely have my flaws. I have my insecurities. I know what they are because I did the research on myself to find out. That is everything for me, is getting the knowledge of who I am. So I'm very clear. It's hard when you grow up in confusion every day because it erodes resiliency. So I needed clarity. It's one of the pillars of my authentic code, is clarity. Things have to be clear for me. So I'm an avid researcher, right? Because I find the study of who I am to be my most passionate pursuit, because I have so much choice in that. I'm not put into the bad girl box by these people that are older and more powerful than me anymore. And so I do a lot of inner child work, my today self work, and I pursue the future me all the time. And so it's a beautiful way to kind of get more deeply into yourself, is to first start with knowledge. You can't love someone you don't know. And you don't get to know yourself in a toxic family who's defining your role in life for you unfairly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I got to tell you, Sherry, I could guarantee it without knowing your daughter. There's somebody that's really benefited from this whole thing, and that's her.
Yeah. Yeah, she has. And I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky. She's the most incredible gift of my life, and loving her. I've never received what she's given, and I never will. But I love the way it feels to give what I didn't get, and to do it with a balance of allowing her optimal levels of frustration, wanting her independence and growth and her differences from me, and knowing that what every child wants is to have the best relationship with their parents they could possibly have, which gives us as parents the most beautiful opportunity to also have the most incredibly self-actualizing relationship we could possibly have with our children.
She's got to have an extremely high level of emotional intelligence.
Oh my God, I'm just guessing. She does, and I would love to take credit for it, but I also think she's just a high-level soul, Nate. I would love to take credit for that, but I just think I was gifted someone so special to kind of make up for all the pain that I've gone through. And you know, now I'm really trying to share and help others. I never thought anyone would read my books. I thought I'd be laughed off planet Earth for calling out family. And so it's been a really nice surprise that I certainly have my haters. The rejected parents really hate me. But yeah.
All those narcissistic parents really don't like you.
Absolutely. Like when they come at me on social media, I don't respond. They're not worth it. But in my mind, I'm like, yep, just as a toxic grandparent would say, or yep, the perfect response from a toxic parent. They just expose themselves. But I have loved it. She has gone through a divorce. I did marry my mother. She has had a lot of pain in that area because I was unable to see my patterns at the time that I married her dad. But she, at 14, she decided she was done. And I allowed that to be her decision. I didn't have to help him get her there. I, in fact, tried to make their relationship for them good because I wanted her to have what I didn't have. And he became very using of me and abusing of me. And I let him know, you're going to see the reality of your relationship when I'm not in the middle, and you're going to be.
I find that fascinating too, that you said that you ended up going romantically in your adult life with the same or similar kind of behavior that you were treated when you were a child by your own parents. And that's that real slippery slope that we try to, oh, I'm never going to do it. I'm not going to be like them. I want nothing to do with them. And then either you end up being like them, or you end up being with someone that's like them, or both. And you ended up going with somebody like that. So for other folks that are in their adult lives looking to date, or they're getting romantically involved, what are some of the signs of these cluster B folks that people should be looking out for?
In the beginning, they're just the best. Like, it's like too good to be true. So there's that saying, like, if it's too good to be true, probably is, right? They're very charismatic. And also, then we have to look at neuroscience too, is that in the beginning of love, new love, on an fMRI, you can't tell the difference between someone newly in love and high on cocaine for 18 months. So like no one's in their rational mind, right? So as soon as that phase kind of pops out and the mask falls off, you'll start to see like, oh God. But because it was so good for so long, you're like, oh my God, we've got to get back to that. Right? I've got to get back to that. I mean, kind of a perfect example, if you watch the Depp v. Heard case.
I was just going to ask you about this. That's hilarious. That was my next question.
Yes. So yeah. Amber, you know, Johnny, they're like, why did you marry her? You know? And he's like, because and I think he even said for like 18 months, it was perfect. It was like just mind blowing. Right. So that's a perfect example of that kind of love. Now, if we really unpack Johnny, he had such a tragic childhood, you know, we are really drawn from our abandonment wounds to love bombing. And you've got to know these patterns and then forgive yourself when you're in it, because the intermittent doses of kindness just give us hope. And then hope is dope. We get in our rope. It's like hanging us, you know, but hope is can be relentless when we want love. And it's just sad that toxic people aren't capable of love, but they know that we want it so bad. So we're very easy to manipulate.
That's interesting too. Yeah. You said that we have to forgive ourselves when we're in it. And cause we all come from different upbringings. So depending on your upbringing, you may be drawn to this kind of thing and be easily sucked in.
Listen, I'm a shrink, okay? I was in the middle of a PhD when I met my husband. And they do say don't meet people in the middle of a PhD because you're like in a weird bubble of things. But I did anyway. We will always marry aspects of our most toxic parent, no matter who it is. But you don't want to marry the full person like I did, right? Because why is that? Why are there always going to be aspects? Well, because we're all flawed. None of us are perfect. I'm not perfect. I have flaws. Of course I have flaws, but I want to work on those flaws and they're not dominating my personality. Again, I'm not a bad person with good moments. I'm a good person with bad moments. You want to know that difference very clear. But when you have 18 months of love bombing, it's really hard for your brain to make that switch. So you probably end up staying in another 18 months trying to fix the freaking thing back to what you had. And maybe even longer, you know what I mean? For many of us. And they can feign a lot of things for a very long time so that we are seduced. We are confused by them.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Sherry, too, because there's people listening right now going, well, wait a second. This might be something that I'm kind of in. But
yeah.
I don't know. Am I really, is this really me? Is this my situation? And then it could be confusing. So, I mean, how do they know, right? How do they know?
I look at it like this. This is personal for me. How often are you scared or irritated? And if that's far over 50%, you've got a problem. I think relationships should be like 80-20. 80%, you're having a great time together. 10 to 20%, you've got some issues, right? Mm. The ultimate goal would be a 90-10 because we're human beings. So we're all going to be stepping on each other's toes a little bit. But when you're not even batting average and you're doing all the work and labor of the relationship and you're the one who's always accused of being wrong and you're perpetually confused, get out.
That's perfectly stated. Dr. Sherry Campbell, we've told you, we've linked it in the book in the show notes. Again, adult survivors of emotionally abusive parents. We've linked your website, drsherrycampbell.com. Real quick, getting close to finishing off. Tell us a little bit about your podcast, Sherapy Sessions.
So my podcast is a $5 subscription podcast. I wanted some part of my work to be a bit private. Also, I put a lot of work into the show, And then there's free bonus episodes that everyone can listen to for free. But I wanted survivors to have a private place to go where I could externalize who I am in this office 40 hours a week as best as I can to people in 20 to 30 minute episodes, knowing it can't substitute for therapy. But the feedback I get on the show is it's the best therapy people have ever had. I make it very practical. I have how-tos and boundaries to set. And I cover every nook and cranny. My upcoming series is going to be on the I'm a burden syndrome, feeling like a burden, and how many of us suffer from it and why it's so stubborn, why it doesn't want to let go. And we continue to see ourselves as a burden. And that all starts in childhood. So there are so many different series, in-law series, toxic mother series, toxic father series, siblings, grandparents, and then all of the defenses and the games they play. So it's really a fantastic show, and it is private. And it gives you a sense of just like a safe place to listen and to feel, and you need a journal or at least notes when you get on my show.
That's beautiful stuff. Everything's linked in the show notes, guys. If you want to learn more, we've also linked Instagram and Facebook. Sherry's following continues to grow. She's got quite a following and putting out a lot of great content. Final question for you. Somebody's listening right now and they're 45 years old and they're like, I cannot believe that I'm still dealing with this kind of stuff with a parent or a toxic family member, even, because that's one of your other books.
Right.
What's overall high level message for those folks?
It's real. What's happening is real. It's strong enough to be labeled as abuse. And you have the right to author the ending of your own life story the way that you choose. It's your life. Grab it back.
That's beautiful. Sherry, awesome stuff. Thank you so much for connecting today.
Thank you, Nate. I appreciate you having me on.